At PNC Private Bank, we want to know what drives you. We call that your why. Once we understand it, we'll build a personalized wealth plan to help you achieve it. So tell us, what's your why? Copyright 2021, the PNC Financial Services Group, Inc. All rights reserved. PNC Bank, National Association, member FDIC.
This is your tech news briefing for Friday, December 3rd. I'm Zoe Thomas for The Wall Street Journal. Nuclear fusion. It's a potentially limitless energy source produced by melding atoms. It's carbon-free, produces little to no waste, and some people think it's the energy of the future. There's just one problem. No one's been able to produce more energy through fusion than it takes to create a fusion reaction in the first place. But that isn't stopping investors from pouring money into the technology. On today's show, our energy reporter Jennifer Hiller will discuss fusion's potential and why investors are getting in now, even though the technology isn't yet proven. That's after these headlines. The Federal Trade Commission is suing to block a major deal in the chip industry. In a lawsuit filed yesterday, the agency said NVIDIA's $40 billion acquisition of the chip design specialist Arm Holdings from SoftBank is anti-competitive. Arm designs and licenses the basic blueprints of chips that are nearly 90% of the world's smartphones. The FTC said the acquisition would give NVIDIA unlawful control over computing technology and designs that rivals need to develop their own competing chips. NVIDIA said last month the FTC had raised concerns about the deal and that it was engaged in discussions with the agency. This is the FTC's first antitrust case since President Biden's nominee Lina Khan took over as chairwoman. Over the past 2 weeks, Elizabeth Holmes, the former CEO of the blood testing startup Theranos, has been testifying in her own defense as part of her criminal fraud trial. She's told the jury she regrets how she responded to criticism of the company. And in one of the trial's most dramatic moments, during questioning from her defense team, she alleged her former boyfriend and number two executive at Theranos, Sunny Balwani, emotionally and sexually abused her for years. Balwani's attorney has denied the allegations. Our reporter Sarah Randazzo has been covering the trial and describes how the prosecution tried to counter that testimony.
When it was their turn to question her, they took it head on, and they took an approach that was a little bit daring, some legal experts have said, which is that they had her read text messages aloud between her and Balwani, which was, you know, a bit of a tense and an emotional period in court because she's reading these messages that appear to be loving messages between them, and the prosecution was trying to say, look, you did have a loving relationship, at least at times, and so it all got a little emotional, both when Elizabeth Holmes was telling her side of the story and when she was reading these texts.
Holmes will be back on the stand Tuesday. You can hear more about her testimony on last night's episode of our sister podcast, What's News? Shares of Grab, the Southeast Asian ride-hailing and delivery company, took a dive on their first day of trading in New York yesterday, closing down over 20%. The Singapore-based company went public through a special purpose acquisition company, or SPAC, that valued it at close to $40 billion, a record for a SPAC deal. Grab has been around for 9 years and operates in 8 countries, including Indonesia, Thailand, and the Philippines, but it's yet to turn a profit. And Planned Parenthood Los Angeles is investigating a cyber attack that exposed the personal information of thousands of patients. A spokesman said the healthcare provider is notifying 400,000 patients whose names, addresses, and other identifying information was breached. Clinical information, which can include details of a patient's diagnosis, procedures, and prescriptions, was also taken in the attack. Patients have been told the hack occurred in October and was limited to the local affiliate of Planned Parenthood LA. All right, coming up, investors are pouring money into a type of green energy that could change the world. Just one problem, no one can commercially produce it yet. We'll explain after the break.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from Betterment, a full-service 401k provider. Attract and retain talent by helping your employees save for retirement and more. No business is too small to get started. Learn more at betterment.com/401k.
Nuclear fusion has long been seen as the holy grail of energy development. In theory, by melding atoms from common elements like hydrogen, you could create nearly limitless energy, and the process would be a lot cleaner than many of the other kinds of energy we currently rely on. So it's no real surprise that as startups work to develop fusion technologies, investors are jumping in, pouring billions of dollars into them in just the past few weeks. In the biggest recent deal, an MIT spinout called Commonwealth Fusion Systems says it raised $1.8 billion this week. But is all that money yielding results, or is this still just a pipe dream? Joining us to discuss is WSJ Energy reporter Jennifer Hiller. Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
So scientists describe nuclear fusion as the holy grail of energy. It's been pursued for a long time, but they haven't been able to make it a reality. Why is it so hard?
It's a really complicated process, and people actually can make fusion reactions happen. The issue is that they have to put more energy in than they're getting back out. And so the real trick to fusion is to try to create net energy, which is where you basically have a machine. And by the virtue of having built this machine, you get energy out of maybe just some seawater or something like that, that there's, you kind of remove fuel almost from the calculus of producing energy.
Can you describe a little bit how this works or how they're hoping to make it work?
Fusion is a kind of nuclear reaction. It's what happens in the core of the sun and other stars, and it's the process of basically smashing atoms together. In the sun, hydrogen nuclei collide and they fuse and make helium, and that releases an enormous amount of energy. But making the sun happen on Earth turns out to be a very difficult problem for scientists and engineers. People have been working on this since around the 1950s. There are different kinds of fusion reactors, and they all look like something that a mad scientist dreamed up, which I mean as a compliment. They're really amazing. But most of these designs rely on fusion that takes place in plasma, which is a really hot charged gas that's held in place by powerful magnets. Hydrogen has to be heated to really high temperatures, 100 million degrees, to form a plasma that allows fusion to happen. The kind of nuclear energy that we use here on Earth is nuclear fission, and that's the process of splitting atoms. The nuclear power plants that we have today use fission, and that power provides about 10% of the world's electricity, and we know how to do that. And those plants are largely carbon-free as well, but one of the issues with fission is what to do with radioactive waste. So fusion wouldn't have that problem of waste, but you also have to get it to work first. So the trick is not only causing fusion to happen, but sustaining it.
Okay, but how many steps are there between, you know, making this a reality and making, you know, a power plant that can generate power for an entire city?
Well, there's a lot of steps in there, definitely. First of all, you have to make fusion work, and you're going to have to do it in a way that then you have enough power that you can control, that you can turn that into basically electricity on the grid. So they've got to be able to produce not only net energy, but take that to the next step of creating net power for the electric grid, which is something that we could use, you know, that we can all relate to. Electricity is something that's actually a product that's useful, not just, you know, can you make the fusion reaction happen in a lab?
Can you tell us a little bit about who's working on making this a reality? We know Commonwealth is one company and they're getting investment, but who else is working on making this the next power of the future?
Besides all of the government research and projects that are going on around the world, there's about 35 private fusion companies working. A lot of them are in the US or in the UK. Commonwealth Fusion Systems is definitely one of the larger ones. Helion Energy also recently announced a big fundraising round. They have $500 million in hand and another $1.7 billion committed that's tied to meeting some performance targets. You know, the Commonwealth fusion raise was $1.8 billion. So there is a lot of serious money at this point going in to some of these private companies.
Why is there so much money going in now? I mean, it doesn't sound like they are able to produce what they are hoping to produce.
Well, I think people are looking for kind of the next big thing, and they see an opportunity here. There's been, you know, the success of some companies like SpaceX, which went out and did something that people didn't think would have been possible. And And so investors are basically looking for the next big idea. And there's a lot of climate pressures right now. There's a lot of talk about net zero and 2050 goals and kind of how you're going to move the needle, you know, towards lower carbon fuels. And they see this as basically an area with a lot of potential, that if you can get this to work, then you've created an entirely new way to make power.
How far from success or from their goals are the companies saying they are?
I mean, there are companies that are saying they're going to have demonstrations of net energy this decade, that, you know, some of them within the next few years, by 2024 or 2025, they're saying that they will have built demonstration projects that can show that they can create net energy. And then once they do that, they expect to start building something that could produce net power, which power being power onto the electric grid. And that we could see that by, you know, the early 2030s, essentially. And that's where there's a big divergence of opinion in the fusion world about timelines and what's possible. There's, you know, a lot of people who will say that they expect projects to be able to show that they can create net energy, but that getting to net power is a whole different ball game. And, you know, so there's people who see that happening in a decade, and there are people who are saying that that's not going to be something that's relevant for several more decades, or that, you know, it could take at least 20 or 30 years to get to that point.
Okay, even assuming it takes just a decade, that's a long way off. There are low carbon or no carbon energy alternatives, wind, solar, hydro, that are commercially viable now. Why aren't investors focusing their money there?
Yeah, that's a great question. There is actually a lot of investment going into wind and solar and batteries. Probably not as much investment going into things like hydro right now. But basically, there is a lot of money just racing into the clean energy space in general. And we do have, you know, like you said, wind and solar work. They're profitable as businesses. So that's a good question. Why not just focus on more of that? And the real issue is reliability and the ability to deliver power 24/7 to the electric grid. So as you produce more wind and solar energy, the issue becomes, what are you supposed to do when the wind isn't blowing and the sun isn't shining, and that you have to provide power round the clock? And people are looking for basically low carbon or no carbon ways to be able to do that. And that's where fusion enters the picture as, you know, a possibility.
All right. That was our reporter, Jennifer Hiller. Thanks for joining us, Jennifer.
Thanks so much.
And that's it for Tech News Briefing this week. Our producer is Julie Chang. Our supervising producer is Chris Zinsley. Our executive producer is Kateri Yoakum. And I'm your host, Zoe Thomas. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.
Adoption of teens from foster care is a topic not enough people know about, and we're here to change that. I'm April Dinwiddie, host of the new podcast, Navigating Adoption, presented by Adopt US Kids. Each episode brings you compelling real-life adoption stories told by the families that live them, with commentary from experts. Visit adoptuskids.org/podcast or subscribe to Navigating Adoption, presented by Adopt US Kids. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Administration for Children and Families and the Ad Council.